This episode is brought to you by Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant. Learn more at kermitlynch.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with an episode about memory.
I've always read and sort of approached cookbooks for more than the recipes. To me, they are full of narrative content and narrative value.
So Malama'aina basically means to take care of the land. For us as Hawaiians, it's taking care of our older sibling.
But I do remember like definitely feeling like self-conscious about it, like being the only one who kind of wasn't eating a sandwich and like didn't have a bag of goldfish or Lunchables.
Listen to Meet and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Eric Asimov. We'll talk to Eric about the past, the present, and the future. I know that sounds vague, but there's a lot in there. I'm your host, Sam Benrubi. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Eric Asimov is the chief wine critic for the New York Times. His tenure with the newspaper goes back to 1984. His column on wine appears Wednesdays in the food section of the Times. His monthly wine school column enlightens and invites you to drink and discuss wine with him. He has published numerous books and guides, including How to Love Wine, A Memoir and a Manifesto. Eric is a prolific tweeter and a fellow New York Jets fan, I'm happy to say. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Eric. Welcome back to the Grape Nation.
Thank you. Go Jets.
That's right. New era. Let's not get too exuberant. We could talk about it at the end. All right. We're talking to Eric remotely via Zencastr. Eric, where are you?
I'm in my apartment in Manhattan, where I've been most of the last 15 months.
Okay, so as you worked, you know, for the Times this past year and a half or whatever, you've been doing it out of your apartment, pretty much haven't left, right? Up until recently, maybe?
Yeah. I've not been a hermit, but, right. You know, I haven't basically left the city. I've been in the apartment, working in the apartment. You know, it's been like everybody else in the pandemic.
Yep.
There's a lot of adjustments.
Yep. You know, I've been talking about every aspect of the pandemic for the past year with basically all my guests, you know, hard not to escape it. You know, I'm hoping now that the pandemic is winding down and maybe it won't be so much top of mind. And I want to discuss the effects of the pandemic. So I want to get right into it with you. You just said that you've been in Manhattan, you've been in your apartment, and you've been working. You publish a weekly column with the Times. How did the pandemic change your life, other than that physical aspect that you weren't in the office?
Well, first of all, I had to cancel, you know, a lot of trips that I had planned to take, some of which I had already bought plane tickets for.
Right.
And, you know, along with those trips are quite a few articles that I had planned to write, which, you know, was impossible. But,
right.
You know, you adjust when current events brings you a different set of circumstances, it changes one's beat as well. And obviously it changed the kinds of stories that I had planned to write. And I ended up instead writing about how the pandemic was affecting the wine business, trying to figure out, articles that would address the concerns of readers, like early on when it all seemed, you know, in New York City that we would be quite isolated for a while. I wrote about the issue of drinking alone.
Right.
And how our society views that, and maybe how people could safely do that.
Right.
So there's a lot of different approaches you have to take.
So we can all understand this. On a typical year, I mean, your column is affected by travel, among other things. You get an opportunity, you know, abroad and here to visit, taste, see people. How many trips, you know, on average, you know, would you typically take in a year?
Well, last year, I probably would have gone to Europe at least three times.
Wow.
I would have been on the West Coast several times, including right around or after the fires that hit Napa.
Right. Right.
And other than that, you know, things happen and you don't necessarily know in advance that a trip is suddenly right. Going to be likely.
Right.
So, you know, all of those are kind of the basic nuts and bolts of writing about wine. There's nothing like visiting the place and seeing the people and, you know, inhaling the air in vineyards and just sensing the cultural vibe that might that goes into producing a certain wine. And these things happen as news happens. You know, something might occur to me and a great story suggests itself. I've got a backlog now of those stories, and I'm hoping to catch up in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, you hit it. It's probably going to take years. When did you realize, like, I think mid-late February, you know, there were stories in the news, and then March it started ramping up, and by the middle end of March, you know, it was here.
Yeah.
When did it change, and you were looking down the barrel of a gun where you had something planned, and like you said, now you had to improvise and come up with a different story or a story that wouldn't be based on travel. When did you realize all this?
Well, it was, you know, right at the beginning of March, I had, there were a couple of things that I had done. I think that I last saw you at the 2020 Charleston Wine and Food Festival, which
Eric, we were there right before the shit hit the fan.
Right before the shit hit the fan. And I came back from that and went directly to a huge dinner at La Palais, which was
right.
celebrating its 20th year in New York. And, you know, that at that event, I really hit me that all of these people were gathered together and none of them were following the protocols that were just beginning to come out. There, you know, people were hugging and tasting
spitting.
From each other's glasses and singing and you know, all of the earmarks of a super spreader event were there. And, you know, thank God that very few people there, as I understand it, got sick. But almost immediately after that, at the end of March, I was supposed to fly to Milan and spend 2 weeks in Piemonte. And, of course, that quickly became an epicenter, just as New York did. So that was off. And, you know, from there, we just, first you thought, oh, we'll put it off 3 weeks, and it's a couple
right.
of months, and then, you know, it kind of rolled into something nobody expected.
Yeah. The Piemonte trip, you missed the 15s and the 16s probably, which have been amazing, right? That would have been a heck of a time. And
you
even
know,
later.
And I had a couple of good stories I wanted to do, and I hope they'll still be available to me.
I'm sure. That That's like a high class problem, having too much material.
But you know,
right?
You know what really bummed me out? I was supposed to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma in July to give a talk on wine there, and I was going to get a private guided tour of the Bob Dylan Center. And of course that was out, and I'm so unhappy about that.
Didn't you tweet a Bob Dylan Charlie Brown cartoon today? Was that you?
I retweeted it. Yeah, because,
retweeted.
You know, yes. Or Monday was his 80th birthday.
Right. Yeah, those are the things on top of the wine. And it's funny you were alluding earlier, you know, about seeing the people and everything. You know, it just proves, and you know this better than anyone else, that wine is a lot more than a liquid in a glass.
Yeah,
and
I mean, and
there's
I've always
wrapped around it.
Yeah, I've always approached it that way, and that's, you know, why it's I've never wanted to just do my job from a desk, because then you can't absorb all of the cultural elements that go into wine. You know, it's far beyond just a beverage.
I think I've discussed this with you, but I don't mind doing it again for my listeners. There are a lot of people out there that review wines and rate them. And, you know, that's a whole nother show you and I could do is, you know, wine ratings and all of that. Your job is, you know, not to, you know, rate wines or whatever. I mean, the elevator pitch of how you approach this, you know, is what? Is that a fair question, Eric?
I think that's a fair question. It's, you know, it's not a short answer, but if I were trying to boil it down, I would just say that wine, yes, it's a beverage, and it gives a lot of pleasure, and it's got to start there, but it can be so much more than that. And when you go into it and look at the traditions of wine, particularly in the old world, where, you know, these traditions go back generations, if not centuries, and, you know, you look at what wines can tell you about the people, and you begin to see them as expressions of a particular group of people or culture, just as their music, their dance, their food is, and it becomes much more resonant to me. And of course, it's also, you know, wine is history, it's politics, it's economics, you know, it's competition, it's health. All of these elements are part of wine, and you know, and of course there's the evaluation of it as an aesthetic object.
Right. And you know, your role is not to, the evaluation is not, you know, numerical or whatever. I mean, it's
no,
a bigger story than that. That's, you know, people don't turn to you for that.
I mean,
that.
Obviously there's, you know, there's good quality and not so good quality. And, you know, a lot of culture wars are fought in wine over these issues. How do you assess that? What should standards be? And so on. And I don't shrink from that, but I don't believe in, you know, the long, the kind of mark of the critic as assessing individual bottles. I think that's just a method of creating a dependency for consumers on critics. And I get the imperative when you're working for a, you know, a wine publication, but I have the luxury of working for a general interest publication, and people might come to me for other reasons.
Right, which is all good. Back to the pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about the significant effects the pandemic had on the wine industry. I think that goes, you know, crosses restaurants, consumers, retailers, you know, people in, you know, the profession, people's wine habits. I mean, did you get any feel that people's preferences and habits changed during the pandemic? Were they drinking more or less? How were they doing it? They weren't in restaurants?
Well, I think they're drinking differently. And of course, it's important to understand that, you know, the pandemic affected different people differently. Right. If you are, you know, in the upper income brackets, you know, chances are you did pretty well during the pandemic. And if you're not, if you're in a service job or in the arts or, you know, any other sort of job that depended on interacting with the public regularly, you may not have done so well. And of course, that very much affects people's drinking habits. Restaurants, as I see it, and for, you know, the section of the wine industry that I'm interested in, restaurants play a crucial role both in particularly in introducing people to new and different wines and in communicating, educating, and persuading people to try them. And when you take restaurants and sommeliers out of the equation, people are kind of left more on their own and tend not to be as exploratory and fall back on things that they know that they like. So,
well, yeah. Also, retailers, you know, at the same point, restaurants were either shut down or, you know, doing takeout. Retailers yes. were closed and they were doing takeout. I mean, right. selling curbside. So the exploration of, you know, going in a store and talking to the owner was gone. So yes, did that create a shift to online and DTC?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that good or bad?
I think that's good in the sense that, you know, it allowed many small wine producers, American wine producers, to survive because, you know, the business plan for many of them is to sell directly to restaurants and their products move through that, through those businesses with the help of sommeliers. These are right. all hand sell products. And that's true in retail also. And, you know, when you don't have that interface, that human interface, the equation has to change. And I was surprised at a lot of American wineries that were able to pivot quickly to direct-to-consumer sales and just sort of build their websites and their DTC sales on the fly. That was really impressive.
You did a story discussing that, and a good chunk of the people in the story, if not all of them, made the pivot and did okay, survived, did well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I talked to a lot of these people at the beginning of the pandemic, and they were sort of in panic mode at the time. Right. And then, you know, speaking to them a year later, they were themselves kind of surprised at how well they did. Of course, there were other problems, you know, came up for the American wine industry that had nothing to do with the pandemic, that in fact were far greater threats to their businesses than the pandemic turned out to be.
That would be climate change?
Well, yeah, at base climate change, but in particular the fires and what that did to their 2020 vintage.
I meant yes. to be sp- yeah. Let's talk about that in a minute. I want to just finish up on the pandemic thing, because categorically, I kind of want to jump into that, focused on that. So wait, a couple things. So wineries pivoted to direct to consumer. In the end, do you think there'll be a net gain to DTC buyers, or, you know, will it fall off? I mean, to me, it sounds like a good thing for the long run. What do you think?
I don't think it will fall off. I think, you know, the old model for wineries with, you know, frequent trips to their big markets and, you know, a lot of in-person kind of thing, I think they've learned that that's not necessary, or at least not necessary to the extent that they were doing it before. Maybe instead of, you know, taking three trips a year to New York, you might take one, and just plan on a lot more online promotion. The bigger question, I think, is, you know, how are restaurants going to respond? You know, if you remember, a lot of restaurants sold off quite a bit of their inventory just to you know, pay their bills. A lot of them let go their wine specialists. We don't know if they're going to be back. I think, you know, the sense I get is that in high-end restaurants are always going to have a huge, you know, a first-rate wine inventory, and to have, you know, dedicated staff to buy and sell those wines. It's the mid-level restaurants that we don't really know about. And the other thing is that, you know, the business model of American restaurants was really exposed. You know, it's incredibly fragile. Employees are basically walking a tightrope, you know, especially those that don't have health benefits, and, you know, restaurants that are just barely staying ahead with rent and things like that. And who knows if Manhattan rents don't change, for example, whether the restaurant industry comes back to the extent that it had existed. I think eventually it will, because big cities thrive on having vibrant restaurant cultures, but it may take 5 years. You know?
Right. It could be set back that long. I mean, that's not unrealistic, right?
And that's true. And one sommelier who I think is very smart was speculating to me that, you know, in the future, wine destinations might well be outside of the big cities, because it's simply easier to pay for rent and for wine storage there. You know, except for the highest end restaurants, wine storage in Manhattan is incredibly difficult logistically.
So that points to two things. And tell me and expand. I think because of that, you're probably, the restaurants that do come back are probably going to have smaller and more curated lists. And I think the idea, and you know, you and I know a handful of restaurants that are, you know, big and fancy and small and cool that have 3, 4, 5 somms working the floor. I don't think the somm thing is, you know, there's, I think a lot of people are going to flee the industry, and I don't think restaurants are going to be able to afford them. Do you agree with the curated list, smaller and somm sort of leaving?
I do think that's the direction we're heading, or if somms are not leaving entirely, they're going to be asked to do other jobs as well, which, you know, really the best sommeliers were completely integrated into their restaurants and would just as soon bus a table as, as sell wine, because that's what good service people do. So it, you know, it might weed out people who were more interested in, you know, the fame of the sommelier rather than right. The hospitality aspects of the job.
Right. Right.
But you know, one other thing to is that a lot of people in the restaurant industry have said to me is that they fear that consumers will have gotten so used to paying retail costs for wine that they will not be willing to go back to restaurant costs.
So that'll bite into the profits and
Yeah. I mean, it may be that, restaurants will have to find a different way rather than, you know, making wine their sole profit center. It may be that there's a whole new reckoning about how restaurant pricing is done, not just of wine, but of food.
Right.
And, I think we saw a little bit of that when Danny Meyer tried to eliminate tips in his restaurants, and
right.
we saw quite a bit of consumer resistance. So, I mean, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So I think in order for restaurants to come back, there's going to have to be some reinvention. And, you know, you noted a bunch of, you know, things that will have to be addressed, you know, the wine pricing, you know, the change in personnel, SOMs are just not going to be these rock stars walking on the floor. They're going to have to run tables back to the kitchen. Getting employees back has been difficult. So we'll see what happens with that. All right. I want to jump to, we definitely could do hours on the pandemic. I want to jump to something that also has grabbed the headlines, the past year, but may have been overshadowed. You know, 2021 started with a terrible frost in France and Italy.
Yes.
And the summer, I mean, Eric, we're almost in June already, and the dry season is approaching in the western, you know, U.S., where they've faced fires virtually every year. Unlike the pandemic, you can't create a vaccine to fight, you know, climate change, to fight the fires, to fight frost.
Yes.
Has climate change in a way been even more disruptive than the pandemic?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, people are able to adapt to the pandemic. Adapting to climate change is way more difficult. And, you know, if you think of California this year, I mean, they're in a drought emergency, and
right.
you know, they already are lacking water. It's already been declared fire season in many parts of the state, and that's way early. And you know, this is kind of the new normal. A lot of people said we're not dealing with climate change anymore; we're dealing with climate emergency,
right.
and. You know, I think that it's a lot bigger than the wine industry, obviously.
Yes. Agriculture.
Agriculture. It's a public health emergency. It's a public emergency on every level, and unless you know serious steps are taken, it's hard to feel optimistic about, you know, one thing that was interesting was then when during the pandemic, when there was kind of a cessation of travel and
right.
And everything, you saw in
the
a lot of ways
how
the air cleared up, the water cleared up. I mean, nature has a way of being able to bounce back, but I would hate for anybody to feel, you know, so sanguine about that they, you know, felt, oh, we don't have to act on an emergency basis now. And, you know, really, I mean, the wine industry is always the canary in the coal mine here. And what's happening with the frost, the you know, deeply destructive frosts in Europe, and, you know, the even more destructive fires in on the West Coast, it's, you know, it just, you wonder, like, at what point does it become untenable for people?
Well, it's untenable. It's not untenable for some people, obviously, because people don't give a crap. You know, I guess it falls into the governments of each country, and it requires a massive effort, right? I mean, it's just a global...
I mean, clearly, it's not just, I mean, it can't be approached on an individual basis. It has to be approached, you know, on a global basis. And just, you know, given the politics of getting anything done in the United States, you know, much less India or China, you know, you just have to hope against hope that
right.
People will realize that they have to overcome whatever their short-term interests are to get this together.
That's going to be difficult. I mean, if you micromanage this, if you take California, you know, which has been fire-ridden, I mean, is there anything, you know, individual wineries and the people that farm them, you know, does moving towards sustainability, you know, cover crops, more diversity? I mean, does that help at a micro level or?
Well, I think we all have to, you know, do our part regardless of
right.
what happens at the government. You know, you can't be fatalistic about it. And, you know, I think there are elements of wine that really have to be rethought. It might surprise people to know that the, you know, single biggest generator of carbon in the wine industry is glass bottles and shipping glass bottles around the world. And
is it the shipping and the manufacturing
it's
or the shipping?
It's both. It's both.
Okay.
And, wow. You know, there are easy things that can be done there. For example, you know, people can wineries can use bottles that are not nearly as massive as
right.
you know, some of the luxury bottles that you see,
right.
and
right.
That's not hard. Jancis Robinson on her website has started, you know, citing the weight of bottles in her wine ratings and
that's
calling out producers who get above a certain weight. And you know what? It's not just, you know, Napa Cabernet or Bordeaux.
I was going to ask you that.
A lot of natural wine producers are just as big offenders as the, you know, the luxury goods and corporate
right.
wine producers. So, I mean, that's one thing that needs to change. But then also, you know, think about the shipping.
Right.
Certainly, you know, we all know that a lot of inexpensive wine is made from bulk wine, which is shipped around the world, not in individual glass bottles, but in big tanks
right.
and then bottled closer to where it's sold. And it may be that has to be extended to other sorts of wines. And you know, there are a lot of obstacles to that. For example, Appellation wines are required, if they want the appellation, to be bottled within the boundaries of that appellation. And
right.
and maybe that has to change. And some other, you know, you have to... One of the reasons for such rules is to prevent fraud.
Right.
But now in an era of climate change, maybe we have to rethink both how we can prevent fraud and how we can ship wine more more sustainably around the world.
I think there's always going to be resistance to change, but I think you're right. Inevitably, you know, the change is going to have to come, yeah. you know, along with other bigger things.
Yes. And of course, as you mentioned, agriculture is a big part of it here. And, you know, a lot of people will have, there's some very complex decisions that have to be made. You know, yeah. people for centuries have traditionally tilled the soil, and that's right. maybe not a good thing for it releases a lot of carbon that otherwise would be stored in the soil. So people have to think about, be open to thinking about no-till agriculture and right. you know, various other alterations into what they've long done.
A more biodiverse environment, possibly, you know, not just this well manicured row of, you know, vines. It may have to be
that too.
Yeah. Eric, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Eric Asimov. Eric Asimov writes for Wine for the New York Times. When we come back, we're going to get into a bunch of other things. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant, an importer, retailer, and wholesaler of fine wine from France and Italy, headquartered in Berkeley, California. In 1972, Kermit Lynch opened a retail shop in Berkeley, California, with a $5,000 loan and a bit of gumption. He started with just 35 cases of wine stacked on the floor. Kermit grew his business from a retailer into a wholesaler and a national importer of wines from France and Italy. These wines are produced by small family growers who are committed to the old world traditions and culture. It is Kermit's belief that great wine is made in the vineyard, not the cellar. Much like his close friends, the late food writer Richard Olney and Chez Panisse's founder Alice Waters, Kermit's influence has been enduring. He has spent nearly half a century shining the spotlight on small artisan producers. Learn more at KermitLynch.com. KermitLynch.com. We're back. We're back with my guest, Eric Asimov. Eric, there's so many contentious issues, but, you know, and I'm doing a wine podcast here, so I want to talk a little about wine, too. You've always been a proponent and a cheerleader for quality to value wines. I mean, I know this firsthand from reading your columns forever. You annually recommend wines, you know, for $20 and under. And the diversity and depth of these wines is incredible. It's just a great guide to go by. Is that price range, like the $20, is that the sweet spot for the majority of consumers? Is that why you do it?
I mean, well, is that, you know,
is that where good wine starts? I mean, I know you've discussed this, you know, the difference between a $10 bottle. But is that the sweet, you know, talk to me about that.
Yeah, I would say the sweet spot is $15 to $25. So I've always, you know, just picked arbitrarily $20 and done, you know, several columns of year, 20 bottles that I recommend all under $20. You know, is that the sweet spot for consumers? Well, if you read my email, I get an awful lot of people who complain that they don't want to spend that much. But,
right.
you know, my argument is that, yeah, if you want to spend $10, fine. But you don't have that many options at $10, where you have a lot of options at $15 to $25.
But fair to say, option of decent wines. I mean, there's a lot of wines.
Yes.
That we're talking,
I mean,
only decent wines. Right.
Well,
good wine.
You know, what do we mean by that? You know, for a lot of people are just, you know, they're looking for essentially an alcohol delivery system,
right.
and they want it to taste good to them, and you know, not be offensive, and they want to spend $5 to $10, and that's fine. But that's not; those are not the people who I'm writing for. My imaginary audience is interested in more than that. They're interested in wines that, as I said before, are expressions of culture, are products of tradition, that are do have a sense of place, are made with craftsmanship rather right. than mass produced. And when you're getting to the $10 and lower range, then you're talking about economies of scale and a lot of mass production and, you know, a lot of grapes from places that maybe are not really very expressive when it comes to wine. You're just talking about the equivalent of soft drinks then.
Right.
And right. and for I'm not telling people if they enjoy those wines, that's fine. But I'm recommending I'm aiming higher in my mind and writing about wines for people who want to go there with me.
Right. Which is also the wine school, too.
Wine school's a slightly different thing, but you know, the idea with that price range is that there's still a really wide range of wines that are made with craftsmanship, that do have a sense of place, that are expressions of culture. You know, you're not going to get Burgundies there or Napa Cabernets, but you're going to have access to a lot of different and unusual wines from around the world that are kind of, the mark of our current period in wine history, the fact that we have access to this incredible range of different wines that we never saw before.
So let's talk about that, because my listeners love Recos. So we talked about the fact that you haven't been able to travel because of the pandemic. So here's a multi-pronged question, and I'll keep you focused on it. When will you commence travel to support your writing? And then, you know, where are you going? But tie that into, tell me some regions and winemakers that have been catching your attention and interest, you know, within the $20 and the beyond the $20 thing, you know, so we're not boxed in, you know, to that one thing.
Let's get away from the $20.
Okay.
Because I'm still talking about value wines really at most levels that I'm writing about. And so, in the last year, the wines of Greece have grabbed me, and particularly the red wines of Greece, because we're, you know, I won't say we're completely familiar with white wines from Greece, but we know right. them better than the red wines. And there's just some terrific wines of all sorts coming from Greece. Germany, too.
Go back to Greece for a second. On the reds, are we talking about a bunch of different grapes? Like when you talk Burgundy, you're talking Pinot. When you talk Greece, are you talking 3-4, you know, different varietals?
We're talking about grapes that most of us, including me, know not very little about.
Okay.
You know, maybe the most famous red grape from Greece is Xenomavro, which is really good, and it's kind of... It's a little bit reminiscent of Nebbiolo with, maybe with some Syrah, but I don't want to play that up too much. It's its own thing. And there's some terrific Xenomavro wines, and they are probably the most promising in terms of ageability and developing complexity over time. But there are a lot of other reds coming from Greece too, and as well as a lot of interesting whites. And, you know, I'm always counseling people just to be open to these things.
That's the biggest thing. You had mentioned Germany, so continue.
Yeah, Germany too, Germany has wonderful Rieslings, but there's so much beyond Riesling as well. Not just Pinot Noir, but there's a growing natural wine scene both in Germany and in Greece. There are Trollinger, for example, known as Schiava in northeastern right. Italy. That's a lovely red wine. And there's all kinds of other kind of ancient grapes like Elbling, which can be is a very interesting white. And you have
spell, spell Elbling.
Elbling. It's Elbling.
Okay, just want to make
or
sure.
Or it could be Elbling. No, I think okay. it's Elbling.
I
get confused without my reference books in front of me all the time. Sylvaner, for example, is right. another grape that we kind of dismiss, but it can be wonderful.
Right. Is there, those are, Greece is less well known and established than Germany, but your point Germany is it goes beyond Riesling. Are there right. any regions that, we know about that, I wouldn't say a renaissance, but you're just excited again about the wines. Like Psalms have been talking about Chianti, when they haven't been for 10 years.
I talk about Chianti all the time. And I have another article upcoming on Chianti.
Tell me a little about that.
Well, Sangiovese is one of my favorite grapes. I just love it, and it can be so good. And I found over time that I'm currently just so crazy about Chianti Classico, and these wines have never been better than they are now. There's a whole range of great producers there, and I think they're just really hitting their stride, and I'm talking mostly about the Normale bottlings, so just Chianti Classico, not Riserva, not the Gran Selezione,
right.
which are the higher end expressions, but just plain Chianti Classico. They're so good and so interesting and so expressive. And I like other expressions of Sangiovese. I love Brunello, and I love Vino Nobile, and
right.
Sangiovese from other parts of Italy. But really, Chianti Classico has just grabbed my attention in a big way. And some of those wines are getting a little bit more expensive, but a lot of really good ones are still in the $20 to $30 range and are terrific.
That show really well, that really
yes.
are good food whites too. Silly question, back against the wall, do you pick Nebbiolo over Sangiovese or Sangiovese over Nebbiolo? Or there's a love, or that's like saying, who's your favorite kid?
Yeah, I mean, I love them both, but right now I find my attention focused more on Sangiovese than Nebbiolo. These things change, though,
Yeah,
let's go beyond Sangiovese. Let's just stipulate that Nebbiolo is just a brilliant grape. But what about Dolcetto, for example?
Yes.
That's
yes.
another one that gets, easily dismissed, and nobody really wants to talk about it. But Dolcetto is a wonderful grape, and there's so many excellent expressions right now of Dolcetto that are really reasonably priced.
Right. I was just going to say, similar to Chianti, compared to the Barolos, even Barbarescos, they're reasonably priced and they're terrific. I'm glad you brought that up because those are some, Italy is so vast, but those are some, well-known opportunities.
I've also been really getting into Italian whites. And I was going to mention another region, Montepulciano, and the Montepulciano d'Abruzzo, which, this area is very well-priced wines. There used to be, mostly big companies that, and the wines weren't that interesting, but I've noticed in the last decade that, a lot of younger producers are going in there and just making beautiful wines. And the white, Trebbiano d'Abruzzo,
is terrific.
Be so good. And, it's important to distinguish that particular grape, Trebbiano d'Abruzzo, from the vast number of other Trebbianos in Italy that are, in fact, different grapes. The actual Trebbiano d'Abruzzo grape is just wonderful and makes really fascinating wines.
Yeah, and there's some terrific makers. Eric, a couple things. I do a thing called the wine list, which you've done before. I want to do it with you. I ask my guests 5 questions about their preferences. They're the same questions I asked you the last time.
Well, it's not a good thing Charleston. I don't remember.
Yeah, you won't. No, and things change too. So, I want to see that. I'll actually do a comparison. But before I get into that, I'm curious. Have you had that meal outside of the house, sort of post-pandemic?
Yes.
Have you done that yet? What was did you order wine? What was
yes.
it?
Yes. Well, I never stopped going. I ate outdoors all summer and into the fall at restaurants. And I kind of stepped back during the winter because I don't need to go to a restaurant badly enough to be freezing or sitting in one of those, ridiculous enclosed shelters that are a poor excuse for eating outside.
Yeah,
I did it once. I'm completely vaccinated and have been back in restaurants and
because I actually bump into people that I just went out for the first time. I wanted to make sure that that wasn't you. Good.
All right. No, but I did have like a return to restaurant meal. I guess it was in the beginning of April. That was kind of a celebration. Both of vaccination, and I had just gotten over COVID then myself. I had it in this
this past April.
I got it at the end of February 2021.
Wow, I got it in March 20.
So
what did you drink? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay.
Whatever was. I mean, there are some.
It didn't matter, right?
Yeah, I there were some great. Wines at that restaurant. I do remember going to Ernesto's and having some great Spanish whites, and that's
downtown.
Another thing I've been fascinated with recently are unfortified Palomino wines from the Jerez region of Spain, Sherry country, made with the Sherry grape, but that are not fortified. And this is a whole new kind of field for me I've had them before, but there's just a bunch of really good ones right now that have been fascinating to me.
So this is Palomino, you're saying?
Yes, that's the grape.
Okay.
Right.
All right. This is an area I'm not, well-versed on. Is Palomino a sherry or it's not a sherry?
No, that's the name of the grape that you see in sherry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's what you're drinking. All right. Maybe we'll talk about that in the wine list. So here's the wine list. 5 questions. Don't dwell on the answers. Buzz through them. You can give me one answer, a couple answers. The first question is, what are you drinking now? You sort of answered that. And the question is usually, what's in your fridge? What are you trying?
Yeah.
I'm
in the middle of my Chianti Classico.
So that's one.
A lot of Chianti Classico.
That's one I was going to say. You sort of answered the question. You have this Palomino, thing.
This Palomino, I'm exploring that as well.
What else?
And, I always have a lot of Chablis around.
Okay.
And especially in the summer, Italian whites, I mentioned the Trebbiano.
What else Italian whites? Like Vermentino? I mean, what else do you like?
Verdicchio, Fiano, Suave,
okay.
Gavi. There's so many good ones.
There is.
Etna Bianco.
Etna Bianco.
Fantastic.
All right, those are good ones.
Yeah.
All right, so this would be a good question to compare when we did it years ago to now. It's the goofiest question on the list, but do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Certainly not something you eat every month, every week, but something, not what you think is a good wine pairing, wine and food pairing, but something that you love, you know, something that just works for you. Could be simple as steak and Cabernet, or it could be something crazy.
Well, I'm actually loving steak in Chianti Classico.
Okay.
But yes, crab cakes and white Burgundy are a great combination.
You answered the question. I'm going to put down steak and Chianti Classico because I think you're dead on that. And crab cakes and white Burgundy is a pretty good answer too. I like that one. I don't remember. I asked this question.
I have one other
go ahead.
Wine that I should mention in terms of Italian whites. Aligoté from Burgundy is a terrific substitute and goes with a lot of the dishes that you'd want an Italian white for, whether pesto or linguine with clams or dishes like that.
It's got a little body to hold up against those foods.
And, of course, this is summer. You know, if the weather were a little cooler, I'd be roasting chickens and drinking it with Northern Rhone wines. Saint-Joseph, a Cornas.
You're among my favorite wines. We kicked this year off with Jean Gonon, who really doesn't do a lot of interviews, and it was terrific to have him on.
He's a great guy.
He makes incredible wine. I got to taste on the show with him. You know, we talked about his wines. That was fun. All right, third question. And if this is awkward or it feels like, you know, you're excluding things, but favorite wine restaurant and or bar, and it's only in the context of who serves great wine, who has a great vibe, who's got a good wine list, who's got people that are knowledgeable. You know, it doesn't have to be fancy. Like I said, it could be a bar. Does anything come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really so into fancy restaurants right now, but yes, the one restaurant that comes to mind immediately is King. In Soho. I love that restaurant.
All around food, Annie's wines, you know, everything, the vibe. They're very good about it. There's a nice, you know, curated wine list. All right. Fourth question. The question is favorite all-time wine. I think when I first asked you this question, I think what I was going for was, Eric, what was the most expensive rare wine you ever drank? The question has morphed into, I don't give a crap to that answer. The question is, Eric, favorite all-time wine, what's that important wine to you? You know, what's the wine that changed the way you think about wine or had an impression or turned you on to Burgundy? Is there an important wine, you know, that's significant to you?
Well, I mean, you know,
the
thing is that, and I have fought this question because I don't think that one just has a single epiphany.
I agree.
I've had many wine epiphanies, and, you know, I can
see epiphany's the answer. The epiphany is more important than the wine to me.
Yeah, I can name the first wine epiphany I had, and it was a 78 Barbera d'Alba from Giacomo Conterno, which back when I drank it in 1982 was like an $8 bottle and is now probably like an $80 bottle. I can talk about a 1955 La Mission, which was the first great older wine I had ever had on my I bought it for my parents' 30th wedding anniversary in 1985,
that's close to a birth year too, right?
Well, it's a little older than I am, I'm happy to say.
Okay.
But I can talk about the first red Burgundy that I remember, which was a modest wine, Haute Côte de Nuit, that just I blew me away. I can talk about the first Mosel Riesling from J.J. Prum Cabinet. That, you know, these are all wines that helped me in my journey. And, you know, are they the most precious wines I've ever had, or the rarest, or, you know?
Right. Well, yeah, that wasn't the point. These are gateway wines or something.
For me, they taught me something important that propelled me in a different direction. And, you know, I've said before, I've learned about wine from the bottom up, and I'm forever grateful for my particular wine education and journey, because I'm a consumer of all sorts of wines, and I believe that the everyday bottles that we drink are more important than the most precious, rarest, most profound bottles that we drink, because they're the ones that really set the tone for how we think about wine, even as these profound bottles kind of stretch the context for us.
Right. That's a great, that's a great point, and I agree with that. And it almost validates a little how silly the question is, but we will move on. Last question is, this is your wheelhouse, and I've been asking it for over 4 years, and our listeners love to tell me the best wine around $15-$20. Give me a red, give me a white. With you, I don't want to get, we just talked about it. With you, I don't want to get into specific winemakers. Just, and if we're repetitive, that's fine. Just give me regions or wines. You know, what's the great value white, the great value red? Red, do we settle on Chianti Classico?
No, because those, you know, you have to go up. They're closer to 25 than 15.
Okay, 15 to 20. So
you
give
might
me a red.
Be talking, yeah, you might be talking about Montepulciano, D'Abruzzo. And there's some really good producers there. And you might be and I would probably be talking about Italian whites. As a whole and field.
You mentioned Verdicchio, Suave, a bunch of other things, Etna Bianco.
Etna Bianco, Fiano.
Those all fit in the 20 buckish, 18, yes. 20 bucks, right?
Okay. Yes.
All right.
I mean, there's a lot more, and I should mention the wines of Portugal, but they're probably a little bit more expensive.
Yeah, but they're good value. I took the family to Portugal a couple of years ago. We went to Alentejo and Port, and I mean, it's just awesome. It's like Italy. The people are friendly. The food is amazing. The wine is amazing. Aesthetically, it's gorgeous.
The language is a little more difficult, but
yeah, I didn't know what was going on. And I took Spanish in high school, but still, it's Portuguese. All right, yes. Eric, we got to wrap up. I told you now we'd go pretty quickly. Let me do a quick wrap up, and then I just want to get a couple of cues from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. But you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation to get to us on both. We're trying to build a little community on Clubhouse, so follow us on Clubhouse at Ben Ruby. I forgot to mention this, Eric. We will post your wine list on our social media sites. People love to see and hear, what you recommended. And I think you carry a lot of sway with that. Eric, if we want to find you on social media, where can we go?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Eric Asimov.
Okay, that is your full name. Your column appears in the food section every Wednesday, pretty much, and the wine
every
school.
Every Wednesday, and it's posted online generally
Monday or Tuesday?
No, it's usually the Thursday before.
Oh, that far ahead.
Yeah, okay. So it's almost a week before, but not always.
Okay. So you can get it in paper on Wednesday and about Thursday or Friday online. And the wine school is about once a month?
Once a month, yeah.
Same thing? Does it come out early online? Or
It's the same thing. And, you know, in that we taste a different wine every month, and there's a lot of interaction between me and readers.
You taste with Psalms, restaurant people?
No. That's another thing entirely.
All right.
What is that New York Times wine panel, which has been on hiatus for the pandemic.
Right. Where you taste 2, 3, 4 wines and or even more.
20 is the protocol. Yeah.
All right. So
school is 3.
Right. That's where I'm confused. So we hope to see that soon. Any books, any other writing in the works?
Always something in the works, but not ready to talk about it yet.
All right. You'll let me know, and then when the right time comes. All right, Eric, I want to thank our guest, Eric Asimov from the New York Times. You've been very insightful, and you've helped us navigate getting out of this silly pandemic. I appreciate you coming on. For the month of May, we brought back old friends. We had Eric on today. We had Raj Parr on. We had Pascaline LePeltier. And we had Dustin Hoffman. And, you know, Dustin's opening a new restaurant. Raj moved from Santa Barbara to Cambria to a regenerative farm. You know, Pascaline is reopening her restaurant. So it's been great, you know, to talk to everybody about that. And Eric, I thank you for, you know, anchoring this at the end. I appreciate you coming on. Yes. Thank you to our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.